So this morning we chanted the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta in English, laying out the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, Middle Way. And it's a central teaching of the Buddha's. And to be able to pick it up and integrate it into our meditation practice, it's really essential. However much meditation we do, or how peaceful the mind becomes, or how refined the mind becomes, without lifting up those Four Noble Truths and reflecting, investigating, and understanding, penetrating them, then it's difficult to get to the essence of the Buddha's teachings. There's a discourse that everybody probably knows, but worthy of recollection, reminding ourselves of that sutta of the Buddha in the Tsingtsapa Grove, and just picking up the handful of leaves and asking the monks that are with him, which are the more numerous, the number of leaves in his hand and the number of leaves in the forest. And of course everybody says that leaves in the forest are way more than what's in his hand. Then the Buddha goes on to say it's similar with the teachings. The things that he's known and understood are like the leaves in the forest, but the things that he teaches are like the leaves in his hand. And and why is that? And it's because as numerous as the different knowledges are, they're not central to the holy life. They're not central to the penetration of freedom from suffering, liberation. But that the Four Noble Truths, they're just these few teachings, this small number, four, is enough and more than enough for being able to get to the heart of a path to liberation. And it's an image that is well known in Buddhist circles. It's the logo for a Baigiri. Although there's a bit of poetic license in the logo. It was a monk who drew the logo. So he used Bodhi leaves, which are meaningful as well. Yeah. But this teaching on the Four Noble Truths as a central piece of where we direct our attention as the mind settles down, or the mind is interested, because sometimes it isn't as if there's a fixed progression of what we should be doing, in the sense of, okay, we should be paying attention to the breath, setting up the mindfulness on the breathing, attending to the breath until the mind becomes very still and peaceful, enters fourth jhanas, and then on coming out of the fourth jhana, then one investigates the Dhamma, and then is liberated. But in the suttas, it's mentioned of the, there's sometimes one develops the kind of tranquility and concentration first, and then one attends to the aspects of insight and knowledge. Sometimes one develops the investigation, insight, and knowledge aspects first, and then develops the tranquility and settling aspects after. Sometimes one does them in conjunction. It's sort of whatever works. That's the operating principle that the Buddha gives us, is, you know, whatever works for allowing us to experience a freedom from suffering. And, you know, the word dukkha, it has so many nuances and so many different translations that I think I'm looking for the day when Buddhism has entered the culture and entered the language so that some of these basic terms you don't have to rely on translations, just use the word dukkha, use the word dhamma, use the word punya. But say for now, who knows, in order to come back and see what's happening with the entry of Buddhist terminology, we'd probably have to be reborn, and I'm not recommending it. But dukkha as suffering, dukkha as that which is unsatisfactory, stressful, difficult, painful. I mean, there's all sorts of nuances from the extreme to the tiniest little nuance, just a little whiff of stress. But the word dukkha is just something that, etymologically, it comes. It's a very old word. It comes from the time before, the Aryans moved into India, and they were probably from the areas of the Asian steppes, and came in and inundated the Indian subcontinent. But they were horse people, and with chariots and carts and horses, and dukkha is dukkha and sukha, happiness and suffering. Do is something not so good, su is something good, and kha is the empty space of the axle of their horse-drawn carts. And you have a place for the axle, and if you've got a dukkha, you got a bad hole for the axle. It doesn't quite fit, and it just doesn't. It's not smooth, and it sort of clumps along, and or is stiff or squeaky or bumpy, and it's all because of that. The hole in the axle, the empty space for the axle, isn't formed properly, so it creates difficulty. When I heard that, the etymological explanation, it made me think of growing up in northern Canada. And in wintertime, if you live where I grew up, then wintertime, it gets quite cold. And then once it gets like minus 40 or so, then the air in the tires kind of shrinks, and then the tires actually freeze, so that you've got this nice flat spot on the bottom of your tire. And then you start going, and clump, 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 clump. The Canadians in the room will empathize. So it's not a smooth ride, it's dukkha. And as we look at the discourse that the Buddha gives on these Four Noble Truths, that contemplation of the different aspects of dukkha, but then the path. Yes, there is this dukkha, and it's probably helpful to reflect on dukkha not as something you have to believe in. You don't have to believe in. It's not a belief system of that there is dukkha, or that there's a cause of dukkha. But there, these are categories of experience to be reflected on and investigated. To reflect and investigate that experience of what is difficult, what is feels incomplete, which feels unfulfilling or not worthy of contentment, and then to be able to tune into that, but not just as a and this is where this aspect of where the Buddha said the three phases and 12 aspects, recognizing that each noble truth has an appropriate response or appropriate action in how we engage with it. The word that the Buddha uses is sort of like a duty that we have to it. The appropriate duty that we have to dukkha is to understand it. It's to be understood. And it's through that understanding and peeling away the reactions and fears and projections that we have with an experience of dukkha, when we're able to actually understand it, then what manifests more clearly is what is its cause. And that is really essential. Dukkha is a given in terms of human existence. We experience all forms of different types of dukkha, and the goal is not to keep a tally and sort of how many forms of dukkha one can rack up in a lifetime, but and see that understanding, so we can understand its cause and to be able to see clearly what's its origin, where does it arise from? Because once it's seen in that way, seeing that origination, seeing the cause, then that cause, we can perform the appropriate action to it or perform the appropriate duty to it, and that is to abandon it. We can abandon the cause. And of course, the habit of the mind and the impulse with dukkha is to try to abandon dukkha, which is quite natural. I mean, who wants to keep it? Who wants to hang on to it? But when we lift it up and attend to it with clarity, then we can understand it. And then it's in that understanding and that knowledge, then the cause can be truly discerned. And then when we're able to abandon, to relinquish the cause, then of course, then we're getting somewhere. Then we're cooking. So that sense of restraining that impulse to, because dukkha is unpleasant by its very nature. But having that patience, restraint, composure that we've been cultivating to attend to our meditation object and objects of attention, then we were able to look at it more clearly and then abandon the cause. And the Buddha points to the different forms of desire as the cause. And in this sense, the word is specific, it's tanha. And by its very nature, tanha is desire that is bound up with greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not desire that is wholesomely motivated. It's not just a fleeting desire, but that's where it went in the chant. It's quite specific, and where it's actually pointed to as the craving which causes rebirth and is bound up with pleasure and lust, ever seeking fresh delight, now here, now there, and namely craving for sense pleasure, craving for existence, craving for annihilation. So those are important to make that distinction in terms of, rather than worrying too much about how filled with desire we are. And just you look around, I mean, one can go into that in itself is the kind of the unwholesome desire, is that kind of projections of me being such a an impure being, miserable, whatnot. I mean, that it's those kind of subtleties that have to be recognized and seen in order to step back and abandon, because the mind is, there is this tangled web of memories and proliferations and worries and fears that are there, and to be able to use these tools to be separating out more clearly. Okay, what is suffering? What is the cause of suffering? And then to be able to attend to that abandoning, and that's what is the complete cessation, giving up, abandonment of that craving, complete release from that craving, and complete detachment from it. So that in practice, say, we don't need to be, although we need to sort of see clearly, to understand and dukkha, and to understand more clearly the causes. But in terms of practice, it's essential that we pay close attention to cessation of dukkha. Now, because if we were suffering all the time, riddled with greed, hatred, and delusion all the time, incessantly, I mean, you wouldn't be here. it'd be too overwhelming. But the reality is that we all experience a cessation of dukkha. I mean, it might not be a final one, but it's there. We have a feel for it. We have an appreciation for it. It's one of the things that pulls us to practice, is that there's an understanding that experience of dukkha is not the only, it's not the only player in the picture. The cessation of dukkha is there. It manifests all the time. And we don't tend to attend to it as closely as we should. And so I think it's really important when we're in meditation to really be lifting it up as an object of attention. Lifting up that feeling of cessation, ending of an experience, and it can just be with a mundane experience, in the sense of just the cessation of the sensation of the breath. The sensation of the breath as it comes in. The cessation of the sensation of the breath. The end of an out-breath. And recognizing that's an ordinary part of the cycles of all nature. And when we get a feel for the natural cycles on a physical realm, we realize that, well, actually on the mental, emotional realm, it's actually exactly the same. It's not separate. And then we can start paying attention to different thoughts, different emotions, and different feelings, watching the presence of them, and then their cessation. Because they're of a compounded nature, and they can't be anything other than impermanent and unstable, so that there is a cessation. And when one attends to that cessation, it's what starts to manifest more. If you start paying attention more to the arising and maintaining of particular moods, then they stay for a while. I mean, it's just you get irritated by somebody, and so rather than paying attention to the cessation of irritation, the habit is to find all the logical reasons why it's a righteous thing to do is to get really irritated and angry, and all the reasons to prop that up, and all the past causes of why they've done it before, they're doing it again. I can't believe that. And it keeps feeding it, so that we're not paying attention to cessation in that way. We're not paying attention to the ending. We're actually feeding it. I remember Ajahn Chah one time talking about practice, and it's like when we practice, it's like we put ourselves into a cage of restraint and composure and the meditation object, and it feels tight and it seems to stir things up so much. He said it's kind of like you take a tiger, it's used to living in the forest, you put it in a cage, and he's not a happy camper. And he roars and he tries to get out of the cage and bats the bars of the cage, and then it gets tired and then it sort of lays down for a bit, gets a bit more energy, and then starts to roar again, and pacing back and forth, trying to get out. And I said, it slowly starts to get used to the cage and gets used to the situation. The main thing is, you don't feed it, and you don't jump into the cage and try to tame it. You make sure that cage is really strong. And so then, over time, what used to be these incredible roars and incredible energy emanating off this cage tiger, after a while, it's just meow, meow. That is similar with the mind, that we are putting ourselves into a cage of composure, mindfulness, training, investigation, and there is a certain element of the mind stirred up, but then learning how to watch and learning how to not feed the habits of mind that are unskillful. Learning how to observe its nature, and so that the mind does settle. So that sense of paying attention to cessation of dukkha, because it's sort of so emotionally potent, we do tend to react, but then learning how to change the relationship, so in that sense of attending to the endings of things, attending to cessation, also the kind of a proactive engagement with that, the Buddha points to the causes of the cessation of dukkha, in the sense of giving up, abandonment of that craving, complete release from that craving, complete detachment from it. And in the Pali, It's a series of words that have similar meanings. Chakho, which is it's an interesting word because it means both giving as well as giving up. So that sense of that chakha there's a certain generosity of spirit that typifies what we're doing. In giving up that habit of craving, we're also giving to ourselves and giving to this whole process. So that quality of bringing up the quality of chakha. Like in the recollections, as we were saying, the anusatis, the recollection of generosity is not dan anusati. It's actually chakha anusati. So it's used for generosity, but it has that dual meaning of giving up as well. So that approaching our practice with both a giving up of those habits, tendencies, the craving, but also a recognition that we have to have a generous spirit behind it. If it's kind of a mean-spirited, I'll give this up so I can annihilate it. It comes back to bite you. So it has to be open-handed and open-hearted. Patinisago is Ajahn Yaniko mentioned it yesterday, and it has relinquishment. But it has the particular connotation of, say, relinquishment of self. So that sense of relinquishment is not just relinquishing a material thing or relinquishing an object of mind, but also relinquishing the self that clings, the self that identifies. So that in terms of if you think about cessation of dukkha, then that relinquishment of the self is such a important piece of the puzzle. Much of our practice can be motivated from self-view of wanting to, I will relinquish this so that I can be free of this, my terrible tendency, or I will cultivate this so that I can be a better person. And those are somewhat practical motivations, but or how do I say understandable motivations, but that whole flavor of self behind it is always going to create more dukkha for itself. So that patinisago, relinquishment and relinquishment of the self that identifies with it as well. Mutti is sort of like freedom, being able to not cling. It's like the word vimutti is from the same, it means freedom and liberation. And mutti is it's that same word. So that there's this sense of freeing the heart from its encumbrances, a letting go we're able to really relinquish, abandon, to give up, and to experience the lightness of that. We carry so many things with us, the burdens of our thoughts and feelings, projections and memories and ideas, views and opinions, and to really be free of those. I'd say an abandoning that And this really allows the heart to shine forth. And the last quality, anālayo, is it's sort of like it's an abandoning, but it's also a non-sticking, non-clinging. So that, one's able to relinquish something, put it down, but not pick it up again. As there's, we put something down, and sort of like you have these little tendrils, and just wanting to pick it up again, hang on to it. That kind of non-sticky nature of the act of relinquishment. So that there's this paying attention in our meditation, in our cultivation, to this quality of the cessation of dukkha. Recognizing that the different forms of desire, as they manifest, that they can be relinquished, they can be let go of. Yes, we identify, yes, they have habit patterns, yes, but we can develop a momentum and a confidence in the ease and clarity that comes from that act of relinquishment. And that third noble truth, the appropriate duty to it or response to it, is realization, to realize the cessation of suffering, to make it real. And just by that, experimenting with letting go, with putting down, with relinquishing, with abandoning, make it real, realize it. And then the cultivation of the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, being the path leading to cessation of dukkha, the path leading to cessation of suffering is to be developed. It's to be cultivated. This Noble Eightfold Path, a right view through the right concentration. So that proper response is the practice, it's training, it's the cultivation, development. And that, the word in Pali is bhavana. Mm-hmm. And when we chant in Pali, bhavetabhati, it's just a bhavana. It's just to bring it into being, develop it, cultivate it. And it's interesting, just in the idiom that's used, or the words that the Buddha uses when the Buddha points to the middle way, this Noble Eightfold Path, that we do the chanting in Pali, Chagu Garlani, Jnana Garlani, Upasamaya Vinyaya, Sambodaya Nibbhanaya. Chahaku is literally means the eye, so it means vision or seeing. But karlani means to make or to produce. It gives vision. It produces vision. That's when we cultivate the path, we develop the path. That's a natural result. That's what it gives. That's what it makes. That's what it produces. Produces vision, produces understanding. It leads to calm, upasamaya, peace. Abhinya is translated here as penetration, but it's say knowledge, heightened knowledge. Sambodaya is here translated as enlightenment, but it's maybe more literally awakening. It's just same root as the word Buddha, to be awake. And sambodhaya sort of mean like a complete awakening. And then nibbhanaya, nibbana, leading to nibbana, leading to the ending of suffering. So that in contemplating these Four Noble Truths, are not just contemplating them as an intellectual pursuit, but contemplating in the sense of lifting them up for reflection, experimenting, testing, trying to get a feel for what does it mean? What's its value? What's its purpose? How does it work? That's where our practice really gains a solid ground, and so that using these Four Noble Truths, and this is where the Buddha puts this, the practice of and development of this and contemplation of these Four Noble Truths as a necessary basis and foundation for the growth in the in our practice. He said it's like if somebody were to say, "I'll build this upper story of this gabled building without having to bother with putting in the first story," and that's an impossibility. There has to be first ground floor in order for the upper story of that building to manifest. And the Buddha says in the same way, if somebody says they're going to kind of produce penetration, enlightenment, liberation by not attending to these and not penetrating these Four Noble Truths, that's an impossibility. And these Four Noble Truths are essential to understand for the realization of the goal of the practice. Because sometimes there's a resistance to contemplating, say, Four Noble Truths, and because it has there's a certain intimidation of contemplating. This is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the path leading to cessation of suffering. And, it sounds either intimidating or pessimistic or negative, but the reality is very different in the sense that, it's so important to understand what the problem is in order to solve it rather than just wishing it away. If we go to a doctor and he asks you where it hurts, you wouldn't think anything. I mean, that's just what a doctor should be doing, figuring out where the problem is in order to be able to diagnose and treat it properly. And this is really exactly the same, that we pick up this experience of these Four Noble Truths in order to kind of diagnose and treat the human condition and to find true kind of well-being and health within it. To offer that for reflection this morning.